Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit by the Groundwire National Coordination Team in Toronto. I'm your host, Fraser McPherson. In this episode...
What British Columbia failed to do was to consult and accommodate First Nations.
Because of my experiences, I demand the status on landing for all migrant workers.
Any media producer can sign up and upload content to the Community Radio Exchange, and anyone can listen to uploaded pieces.
But first, here are the headlines. Teck Metals Limited is charged with violations of the Fisheries Act and the Environmental Management Act, and plans to plead guilty on Monday, February 1st, for releasing toxic waste into the environment in 2013 and 2014. Catherine Fisher from CJLY brings us this headline.
Teck Metals Limited, which operates the world's largest lead-zinc smelter, plans to plead guilty on Monday, February 1st, to 15 charges of causing pollution stemming from incidents in Trail, BC. Trail is a community of about 7,000 people located in interior BC on Sinike's traditional territory. Teck, which is the region's largest employer, is being charged with violations of the Fisheries Act and the Environmental Management Act, specifically for discharging copper, zinc, and other caustic waste from a fertilizer plant and a metallurgical plant into the environment in 2013 and 2014. Teck's acknowledged and been fined for numerous toxic spills over the last few years, but the destructive practices arising from the Trail smelter, originally called Cominco, actually date back much further to 1896. More recently, in 2008, Teck accidentally dumped 1,000 kilograms of lead solution into the Columbia River. They were later fined $115,000 for what the trial judge called significant negligence. In 2011, the company was fined $325,000 for two other chemical spills in Trail, including one where mercury was released, also into the Columbia River. In 2013, Teck paid $210,000, this time for discharging sodium hydroxide into the river. Teck owns or has an interest in 13 mines, one large metallurgical complex, a wind power facility, and several major development projects in Canada, the United States, Chile, and Peru.
The commemorative march for missing and murdered Indigenous women is coming up in Montreal. Audrey O'Braham brings us this headline from the Missing Justice Committee.
Montreal-based organization Missing Justice continues to honor the memory of the missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada and raise awareness about this issue. The 7th annual March for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women will occur on Sunday, February 14th at 3 p.m. It will begin at Saint-Laurent Metro in Montreal. For Groundwire News, I am Audrey O'Braham.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
We can't change the past, only protect the future. Keep defending land. Don't let settlers fool ya. Treaties never died. They still have memories. Settlers are alive. We still have enemies and allies too. All races befriended me because we are treaty people, fundamentally and uphold peace. We still have memories of sacred traditions and all their complexity for self-defense. We still have weaponry. Don't mess with me, physically or mentally. While I heal from my ancestors' enemy to win black and native freedom eventually. I don't know more, my ancestors sending me to go and fight for those who descend from me. I don't know more applies to my people too. Africans, Caribbeans need a boost. I don't know more. 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 I don't know more.
You just heard Idle No More by Wasson featuring Science and James Blood from Wasson's latest album, Comrade Music. Now it's time for our feature stories. The Supreme Court of British Columbia has ruled against the assessment for Enbridge's Northern Gateway pipeline. The Supreme Court found that the project's assessment did not address concerns of the province, nor obtain consent from Gitgat First Nations. CKUT brings us this interview with Art Starrett, who discusses the province's puzzling decision to leave the assessment in the hands of the National Energy Board.
Yeah, my name is Art Starrett. I've been active in land use planning, marine use planning, and economic development on the coast of British Columbia for about the last 15 years. In particular, an area known as the Great Bear Rainforest is an area that I spent many, many years championing on behalf of all coastal First Nations. And more recently, I was engaged in a court case, which is intended to address the issue of the Northern Gateway pipeline and tankers on the coast, north coast of British Columbia. And the reason for that was to make sure that we protect what we have in the area, the amazing land use plans and marine use plans and economic development initiatives that we've created in the area.
Not a couple of days ago, we heard the final ruling. The province was found to be in breach of the Crown, because normally the assessment for the program is supposed to be done by the province, in which case they would have to get consent and work alongside your communities there, First Nations communities. And in this case, they had not done that. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, what British Columbia failed to do was to consult and accommodate First Nations with regard to the decision around Northern Gateway. And what they did do is they entered into what's called an equivalency agreement, right, whereby they say that the environmental assessment that's done by the National Energy Board is equivalent to one that they would do. So in saying that, they're saying if you do that, then we will recognize your decision because we think it's equivalent to what we do. We took exception to that as the Gitgat Nation, because British Columbia and Canada do not have an equivalent agreement. In
right.
fact, BC has more stringent environmental conditions. In fact, they laid out five conditions for Northern Gateway, informed the National Energy Board that they shouldn't approve the project, but just left it at that. But in fact, when they were informing the National Energy Board that they didn't approve the project, that they felt that Northern Gateway or Enbridge had not met their conditions, they actually had the opportunity to remove themselves from the equivalency agreement and decide whether or not to sign off on an environmental certificate or assessment of British Columbians' own making. And they didn't do that. So on one side, they were speaking against it, saying don't approve. On the other side, they themselves could have rejected the presentation that was made by Northern Gateway. And that just didn't sit right with the Gitgat.
Right. So far, people are saying the project is all but dead in official terms. They're saying that they do have the federal go-ahead, quote-unquote, in your opinion, do you think that this is the end for this particular project, or do you think they have any sort of recourse? Because I know that the current ruling, they are reviewing it, the Supreme Court is reviewing it. Do you think that this could come back in the future, and in what sort of power?
Well, the Supreme Court won't be reviewing it. This is a Supreme Court of British Columbia decision. I'm sure British Columbia is reviewing it.
Right.
You know, they have the option of appealing it or not. We think we've done them a big favor. We think that we have put a court case out there that describes very clearly what British Columbia's power is. And we think that's a good thing.
Right, yes.
Particularly in light of the fact that British Columbia has opposed Northern Gateway. And more recently, they've opposed Kinder Morgan. This gives them the opportunity to act on their opposition and to impose the very stringent environmental conditions that British Columbia has. British Columbia also has much greater oversight once projects are approved to make sure that things are done properly and protected into the future. So I wouldn't expect that British Columbia would oppose something that gives them greater power.
Right.
However, you never know. You never know if they want to continue to duck their responsibility, then I guess we'll end up going to a higher court. There is one mistake that is being made in this whole exercise, and that's, for example, Enbridge Northern Gateway is saying, well, this court case doesn't matter. The National Energy Board has the power here. Well, that's not true. And it's not true because the Supreme Court of British Columbia said it's not true. Now, we've been saying this now since 2013. This didn't just start yesterday. The Coastal First Nations and the Gitgat Nation in particular said to British Columbia back then, look, you need to take back your power. You can't just delegate it without discussing that with us. And so we have now brought a lot of clarity to this issue and I think empowered British Columbia with regard to these processes and empowered them in terms of their ability to negotiate with industry.
To mark the 50th anniversary of the Migrant Farm Workers Program, Justicia for Migrant Workers will be organizing actions across Canada to highlight the resistance that migrant farm workers have undertaken to counter the exploitation they face as a result of inhumane immigration policies. They launched their Harvesting Freedom campaign last week in Ottawa.
On Monday, January 25th, the advocacy group Justicia for Migrant Workers launched their historic Harvesting Freedom campaign. The campaign calls on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to grant migrant farm workers immigration status upon arrival rather than the current model that leaves workers vulnerable to abuse. Harvesting Freedom is a year-long campaign that will feature a pilgrimage to Ottawa set to arrive on October 2nd, 2016. At the press conference, migrants spoke about the difficulties they encountered with the various temporary labor programs in Canada that allowed for exploited and easy access to needed labor without providing a pathway to citizenship. We hear of the experiences from two migrant workers, Gina and Alberto, and their calls for the granting of permanent status for migrant workers.
Good morning, I'm Gina from the Philippines. I came to Canada under the Temporary Foreign Worker Program. I worked in vegetable packing, hotel, and food industry. Low-wage workers like myself coming to Canada in the Temporary Foreign Worker Program, the Seasonal Agricultural Worker Program, the Caregiver Program, are tied to employers. Single employer, closed, which means closed work permit. This means that we are subject to abuse, exploitation, and separation from our families. I lost my first job because I tried to speak up. I tried to fight for my rights and recruitment fees. I helped other co-workers to speak up, and they were threatened of deportation. I helped another worker to get back the money paid for recruitment fees, and I ended up losing another job. I witnessed many migrant workers who are abused, exploited, and can't speak up because of their fear of being deported and losing their job. Because of my experiences, I demand the status on landing for all migrant workers. Thank you.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for coming and listening to us. I was working as a temporary worker in a farm in Leamington, where I suffered an accident because my employer didn't provide me with safety equipment or training, nor treatment, or even helping me after my accident. So I complained to the Minister of Labor, and he got a fine. But after that, I was the target of a harassment, and finally, he fired me and sent back to Mexico. If we had immigration status, employers we will push it to improve working conditions, homologating them to the jobs in other industries, in order to keep his work with them. And no one gonna leave his job if he is happy with it. I have to tell every person who comes to Canada to work, comes grateful and happy for the opportunity. But when they arrive, they face the cruel reality and feel like a slave. We are convinced that immigration status is the smarter and easy way to stop abuse of migrants workers in Canada. Thank you.
We also spoke with Ricky Joseph, who has been a temporary worker with the Seasonal Agriculture Workers Program on a farm in southern Ontario for the past 4 years. Ricky told us about the difficulties in being away from his family, who live in St. Lucia, for such long periods of time while working on farms in southern Ontario.
For example, today I was in touch with some of my relatives, and what happened is, in my situation, I have two kids. The mom passed away roughly 11 years ago. I'm the sole breadwinner for these children, and to be spending so much time away from them, that is really, really tough. Today, roughly an hour ago, I was told that my daughter, she's skipping school and to spend time with her boyfriend. So skipping school means, you know what is happening, right? Skipping school, that means she's missing out, right? Basically, it's all as a result of I spending so much time away from them. My son, I was just told that he's using drugs. And again, I'm not there. The mom is out of the picture, and I am out of the picture. So what can really help me? And I mean, what is the point in life of earning money and you can't share it with the people who matter to you most? Who are the people that matter most? It's your family, right? And the program as it is, it keeps you separated from your family. There's only one way I think that's possible to be working and have your family next to you is granting permanent residence or status on arrival for migrant workers.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Seasonal Agriculture Worker Program, and Justica for Migrant Workers will be organizing actions across Canada to highlight the resistance that migrant farm workers have undertaken to counter the exploitation they face as a result of inhumane immigration policies. Reporting for Groundwire, this is Ome Samara Hemtula on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit in Toronto.
For our final feature, Sophie Harkat, wife of Muhammad Harkat, speaks about her husband's treatment and about living as a prisoner in her own home. Muhammad was arrested in 2002 under suspicions of having ties to Al-Qaeda. Muhammad spent 4 years in prison and has lived under house arrest for the past 7 years. The Supreme Court of Canada has upheld the security certificate that keeps him a figure of interest, and he is now facing deportation to Algeria.
So could you just briefly explain what a security certificate is and why you believe it violates the fundamental principles of justice?
A security certificate is under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. It's a piece of legislation that basically allows the government to arrest non-Canadian citizens, either refugees, landed immigrant, or non-status, and basically call them threat to national security and detain them for indefinitely without charge and without access to the evidence. So basically, your public counsels are kept in the dark about the evidence, and you're given a summary of allegations. It's not based on actual proof. It says that we allege, we assume, we think that in the past, present, or future, this person may be involved in acts of terrorism, part of the network. The decision is based on reasonable grounds to believe that the person might be associated to terrorism. So it's the lowest standard of proof in Canadian courts.
And what allegations were made against your husband?
Well, there's several allegations, but then again, it's important to mention allegations. One of the main allegations is that my husband went to Afghanistan, and he denies being in Afghanistan. He's never been there, and that he ran a guest house in Pakistan for members of Al-Qaeda, which he's never done, and he doesn't know the people that are mentioned in the report as well. The day he was released on bail, I became a full-time prisoner in my home and a full-time jail guard. The conditions were that he had to wear a GPS around his ankle 24/7. He could never take it off. He wore that for 7.5 years. We had 2 surveillance cameras in the home. Our phone was intercepted. Our mail was open. He had to be watched 24/7 inside the residence as well. So that would, at the beginning, there would be just myself, my mother, and a member of our committee that was allowed to do that. My mother works 15 hours a day, so I would do about 95% of the supervision. So that meant that I could not go to work or leave him alone. We were allowed to go out 3 times a week for a maximum of 4 hours. Every outing had to be pre-approved in advance, at least 48 to 96 hours in advance. So it was a very stressful, dehumanizing time for us. In 2009, the Canadian Intelligence Secret Services decided to drop the conditions, because that's the case against my husband, because they had assessed that he wasn't as big of a threat as they initially thought he was. So the majority of the conditions were lifted, except for the bracelet and several other conditions. For example, he's not allowed to be around technology like computers and cell phones. Just recently, he was allowed to have his own computer, but it's a monitored computer by the CBSA, and a cell phone as well. He doesn't have one at this present time, but he's allowed to have a specific model that would be monitored by the Canadian Border Service Agency as well. When they say a security certificate targets, for example, Muslim men or people without status, that is untrue, because when you become a surety to your own husband, you become a full-time jail guard, you become a prisoner in your home. Every person in my family had to be screened for a security clearance. Every friend that we had, we always lived around most conditions, so we were always planning our Christmas and other special occasions around most conditions. Several times he offered to go back in jail, but that was out of the question. But we all suffered, and everybody that loved him and everybody that knew him had to pass clearance and live with the conditions while around Mo. So it was difficult on everyone. In our case, our informant failed the lie detector test. CSIS lied to it about, well, not lied, but they never informed the judge about the results of the lie detector test. So the majority of the allegations are from that main informant. And when the Supreme Court ruled the first time that security certificates were unconstitutional, the government had 1 year to redraft a new law. In that law, they put in place some special advocates, which are security-cleared lawyers, which have access to the secret evidence, but they cannot discuss the information with the detainee and the public counsel, so we are left basically in the same position. The special advocates have mentioned several times that their hands continue to be tied behind their back. He's facing deportation because the main goal of a certificate is to deport someone back to their country because they're a so-called threat to national security. At this point in time, we're fighting the deportation. We've fought as much as we could on the law itself. So the only thing we have left is fighting the deportation law.
Now it's time for our community radio report. In 2006, the National Campus and Community Radio Association, NCRA, put together its first iteration of the Program Exchange, a digital system used to help distribute content among its members and media producers across the country for campus and community programming. Even at the early stages of file distribution, the NCRA recognized the importance of content sharing to members who would normally not have access to broadcast media aimed at meeting the sector's mandates. In November 2014, the NCRA recognized, through input from its membership, that there was now a need to update the program exchange, and with funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada, sought to make the necessary updates. On January 20, 2016, the NCRA launched a revamped site with added features to make sharing audio more accessible, such as a new design, the possibility of sharing and collaborating on a series, podcasting capabilities, and national log sheets. The idea of sharing content speaks to the very concept of community media, which is about pooling resources and helping the community. Gretchen King is a longtime community radio programmer and was part of the news collective that forwarded the idea of a platform to share content in 2004, and also speaks to the importance of content sharing. Catherine Fisher from CJLY in Nelson, BC, tells us about her experience with the program exchange and its importance to her community.
In terms of the program exchange, part of the history of that exchange coming forward as a resource for all National Campus Community Radio Association members was that at one annual conference back in 2004 in Edmonton, a community news convergence took place, bringing together community news programmers from across the country. And one of the needs that came out of that convergence, as identified by people interested in doing news programming and sharing a news program together, was that we'd need a place to be able to exchange our programming. And so we decided that we'd put forward a motion for the General Assembly to consider developing a shared platform for exchanging community radio programming. And so that was passed by the membership, and within a couple of years, the NCRA exchange was launched. And over the years, it's become a really valuable platform, not just for exchanging programming and sharing programming between stations, but also collaborating on programming together as a national sector that's trying to create a national voice representing diverse communities across Canada. And so we've used this exchange over the years to produce the Homelessness Marathon, which is a 14-hour radio marathon that happens live, but does include pre-recorded programming from across Canada as well. We've also used that exchange to produce the national editions of the Nakba broadcast, or the broadcast commemorating the Palestinian catastrophe in 1948. And we used the exchange to upload various programs, various panels, various discussions that fed into that bigger national and, in fact, international broadcast commemorating the 1948 Palestinian catastrophe, or Nakba. So the exchange in and of itself is not just valuable to connect stations to other stations' programming, but also providing that alternative platform by which we can create national programming.
It used to be called the National Campus and Community Radio Association's Program Exchange, but now it's been updated and relaunched with support from the Community Radio Fund of Canada as the Community Radio Exchange. I'm a longtime community radio volunteer living in the small semi-rural community of Nelson, BC, and my station, which is Kootenai Co-op Radio, uses the program exchange all the time. We're very proud of our local programming, but being able to share interesting and thought-provoking stories from diverse and grassroots communities in Toronto, Halifax, Lethbridge, Abbotsford, Winnipeg, and Windsor with our listeners is amazing. We frequently get calls from local listeners who appreciate that we can offer them this little window into other community radio stations and podcasts from all across Canada. Any media producer can sign up and upload content to the Community Radio Exchange, and anyone can listen to uploaded pieces. The exchange is searchable by topic, program type, program length, producer, or series. You can find the Community Program Exchange at previous.ncra.ca.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. Music this week was by Wasson, off his new EP, Comrade Music. Headlines this week were written by Audrey O'Brien and Catherine Fisher. We also thank Matt Weilish, Gretchen King, Ome Salma Rahmatullah, and Chris Ramzarup. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or podcast it at rabble.ca/podcasts, or download it at groundwire.ncra.ca.